Hello everyone and welcome to this Nintendo Life episode 89. My name is NBZ and I am joined by everyone's favorite American. His name is Bally. Bally, welcome to the show.
Hi NBZ, I'm in the land of WrestleMania.
Yeah, apparently you're literally in Orlando right now.
I'm literally in
Have
Orlando.
You seen Dan Reichert?
I haven't. I've not looked particularly hard for him. To be honest, the only WrestleMania-related thing I've literally seen is when I drove from the airport to our resort and saw literally a sign saying, "Welcome to WrestleMania," and that was it.
Okay.
That's
well,
all I've seen.
You know, that they'll all be crammed into centres and convention places and things like that, I imagine.
I'm sure, yeah.
I recall Dan saying on the Beastcast that he basically would rather just have a hotel room inside the arena or just sleep in the arena for the whole time, because that's basically where they stay anyway. But yes, we should also mention that, you know, because you're off on the other side of the world, you don't have your nice microphone with you.
So apologies
for the step down in audio quality. It'll be hopefully just for this episode. I mean, you're going to be back before the next episode, right?
Maybe not. We can
we'll figure it out. I don't know, but yes, fun times ahead. Look, we're across an ocean, Bally. There's an ocean between us, but a podcast will still be recorded because that's the way we roll. So we have a show in which we talk about things. How about you tell people the things we talk about on the show?
So we're going to talk about what we've been playing. We've got a slightly longer segment. We're going to run through lots of little things, I think, and then we'll do for our second segment some emails. We're going to keep it as a two-segment show, and we'll throw in like an extra email as well, and yeah, wrap it up with that.
Yeah, it's been a busy period for both of us, I think, and you being away and me having a lot of work to do, and we're recording this at the last minute, so we'll hopefully be back to a normal show next time. But you know, it's what's called for. Yeah, we hope so. So, Bally, let's kick things off then with the video games, what we've been playing. How about you kick us off?
Sure. So, I thought I'd talk a little bit about the experience of traveling the Atlantic with the Nintendo Switch.
Okay, this is a great test case because it's just come out and you are immediately off across the ocean. How does the battery life fare? How are all these things? Tell me your story. Weave me a yarn.
So, I bought a case online on Amazon UK and it got delivered to my address in Edinburgh, and then I'm actually meeting my parents out here in Orlando, so they actually took the case from Edinburgh to Orlando, and I traveled without a case, and I sort of traveled with the Joy-Con in one area and then the tablet screen itself, the Switch, in another area, and that was all fine. I've been looking up lots about the airline I was flying on. So I was flying on Aer Lingus, and I was trying to work out, like, will I get a plug? Will I not get a plug? And it seemed to be that some planes in their fleet did have plugs and others didn't. All of the ones in business class did. And it seemed that all the ones that were in economy didn't. I was traveling in economy and I didn't have a plug. So
nightmare scenario.
Yeah. And especially because I lent my 3DS to my girlfriend Caroline to play Link Between Worlds while I'm on holiday. So I was purely with the Switch. I'm purely with Zelda this holiday. And I knew I had one battery life fully charged of the Switch to play. And I turned down the brightness a bit, and I was obviously on airplane mode, and what else did I do? There's one more thing. I don't know. I think that, yeah, well, the wireless airplane mode, exactly. So I believe I got about 3 hours to maybe 3.5 hours, or maybe about 3 hours, 15 minutes of one charge all the way through. And I actually forgot about the feature where the Switch itself will go into like sleep mode when it's running out of power, where you're able to charge it within, I don't know what the time period is. I think you can, it'll go into that sleep mode for like another 24 hours or something. Like, you've got that sort of 2% where it'll just save it and like save state your game essentially in sleep mode. So I forgot about that mode, so I was sort of cautious and I saved and switched off at about 5%. And it was good. It was great just playing Zelda Breath of the Wild in the sky, traveling across the Atlantic. And I think that, yes, the battery life is really bad, and that's a shame. But in terms of a portable system, that's one aspect that is not good about it. But ultimately, another thing that is actually really good about it is that I brought the dock with me as well in my HDMI cable. So I'm literally only carrying an extra dock, which is obviously, for those who don't own a Switch, is literally about the same size as a Switch, maybe times two. Plus, you know, I've got the Joy-Con grip and I've got the HDMI cable. So I've got a huge HDTV at the resort we're staying at, and I'm able to plug in Zelda and play away on that. So in terms of combining traveling across the Atlantic, and yes, the battery life wasn't great, but ultimately, for not carrying very much, I can play on a huge HDTV. And in the past, I have brought my Wii U to the States when I've traveled before, and it has been doable, but not much fun, just quite simply because the Wii U is so much bulkier than what the Switch
is. It is a heavy object, the Wii U. You could probably kill someone with a Wii U. I'm not sure you could kill someone with a Switch.
Yeah,
you
know? Definitely not.
It has some heft to it.
Yeah, I just think it's such an awesome system for traveling with. Obviously,
it's the sort of thing you can literally throw it in your backpack, right? Because the dock itself is actually slim, and the Switch is obviously portable. And then you have a couple of wires. That is a backpack scenario. It's not like, you know, with a PS4 where you probably have to take a fucking briefcase for it, right?
Right.
The added benefit is, hey, you can play it on the plane while you're going there too.
Exactly. It's in my backpack. I've also got my laptop in my bag. I've got other stuff in my bag, and it's just the days when I had the Wii U in my backpack with my laptop, I could barely fit a book in whatever. Whereas this time I had a book, I had spare space, it was great, and I had my Switch, it was fantastic.
The Wii U problem is also because the gamepad itself is so fat, right? That thing takes up so much room.
I really worried about Wii U gamepad analog sticks and getting them mucked up, and ultimately they're attached to the gamepad itself, so you can't replace them. Yes, I'm concerned about the Joy-Cons, but ultimately I know that even if I really mucked up one of those analog sticks, I can buy more Joy-Cons. As expensive as they are, and it's not ideal, I don't have to buy an entire new Wii U like you would with the Wii U if you ruined one of them.
Right, because they never sold the gamepad separately.
They never sold the gamepad separately. And
yeah,
the Switch is just a lot better for that. And So I was traveling without a case, like I said, and I had a protective area of my bag that I knew wouldn't scratch the Switch. So that was great. Once I was over here, like I said, my parents had brought over the case I bought online. You had just been looking up the case, actually, online, MBZ. Can you remember the name of it?
It's a Hori one. I don't know what specifically the name of the case is, but
sure.
Hori are well known, I think, for creating products that, I think one of the ones they made was the stand, which was, everyone was talking about, why would you need that stand? And then everyone realized, oh wait, you can't charge it in tabletop mode because the bottom of it is where the charging cable would go in. So that's why they created that, which was kind of a weird scenario. But yeah, they've created a lot of products in the past. It's a tough case though, right? So it has a hard outer shell, means you can kind of throw it around a bit and it hopefully won't get damaged.
Yeah, it's very hard. And I was showing it to you on Skype just before our recording sesh, and there is an awful lot of extra space in this case. I joked that you could keep a few N64 games in here alongside the Switch, and I don't really know what they think you're meant to put in the rest of this case. But ultimately, I thought that I could easily fit my 3DS in this case, so I could definitely come on holiday or travel in the future with both my Switch and 3DS all in one case, and it'd be really it'll be a heavy block, and it's fairly large, but it's perfect for just sticking in the backpack. So yeah, I'll tweet about this case on my Twitter account at Ballyman91, but I can put a link there or tweet more about it. But it works well, and yeah, like I said, it was about £15, so pretty affordable. I would highly recommend, and it does have a sort of panel that you can keep Switch games on that sort of flaps down on top of the screen, and I hadn't noticed the elastic bands before our call, MBZ, but they sort of keep the Switch in the bottom of it. So even though there's that extra space, there's no danger of the Switch sort of flying about inside the case, which is nice.
Right,
so, yeah,
I had to ask you about, because you're like, oh, how did this, like, it seems like it's just going to knock around. I'm like, yeah. There should be like something that dulled it down.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh my God, I didn't notice there are straps. Yeah.
So
I have to tell you these things.
I would highly recommend getting a case. I never got one for my new 3DS, and ultimately...
Well, the thing is, right, is the 3DS, and since DS, for the last 10 years of Nintendo handhelds, we've not needed to worry about a case solution. I have always just thrown my 3DS in my bag, my DS in my backpack. Like, you can throw it in your pocket. Like, it was portable enough to where you don't have to worry about any damage happening, because Nintendo have built that damage solution in for you. I wonder, interestingly enough, like... because this is the case, if we will see like a sharp uptick in sales for carrying cases on Nintendo's end versus the last 10 years, because I don't know how many people really felt the need to go out and get one for the last line of systems.
And like, I know that I think NVC, Nintendo Voice Chat, I should say, were talking about how there was an uptick in screen protector sales for the Switch.
Yes.
But when you think about like Nintendo handhelds, it's really just systems like the Game Boy Advance. It was way back to the Game Boy Advance, the Micro, and I guess you can argue, obviously, the 2DS, where they've done sort of an open sandwich design before.
Right.
But otherwise, they've been clamshell for a long time between the SP, the 3DS, and the DS in between those two. So
it really makes you think how smart the original DS design was. Like, as kind of clunky as that first DS was, it solves so many problems. That clamshell is like, okay, don't need a screen protector, don't need a carrying case. Like, it basically takes away these hidden costs, which the Switch is now bringing back. I think a lot of people are kind of maybe annoyed that there are a lot of hidden costs associated with the Switch itself.
But, yeah, definitely. But,
the sacrifice is because we get, a console on the go.
I mean, we're getting an incredible console on the go with Zelda. I think that as a travel experience, if you have a decent case and if you can be lucky enough to get a plug on a plane, it's pretty perfect. I didn't have a plug, and that's a shame, but...
One question I have that I think is important is how loud is the headphone stuff coming out the Switch? Because that's the thing, when you're traveling on a plane, you're having headphones on. Sometimes the stuff around you is going to block out that noise. And obviously that depends on the quality of the headphones you're using. But is the Switch loud enough?
I had the volume on full on the plane, and it worked well. It was good.
Okay.
I have my headphones, MZ. They're sort of in-ear. They're fairly standard these days.
Ones that I fucking hate, because they make it so painful for me.
They're sort of in-ear with squidgy things. I don't know how you describe it. And they're not made by Apple.
They're basically the standard earphone these days, and I hate that. That's become the paradigm, because I can't stand them. And trying to find just normal headphones is a damn pain in the ass.
I certainly want to buy some over-ear noise-reducing headphones, which I used to have, and I need a new pair. On planes, those were just an absolute joy to play. And I think combine that with, the orchestral soundtrack of Breath of the Wild, and I think on a plane you'd have a really good time. So I can't recommend regular headphones versus noise cancelling, because they're obviously way better, but it held up well. It's loud enough, and that works.
Okay.
Overall,
that's good to know.
Good experience. I'm glad I brought my Switch. Got lots of Zelda left to play while I'm on holiday.
Did you try out the kickstand mode at all while you're on the plane and pop it in the grip,
God,
or you just play on handheld?
I was just handheld. I didn't even want to try. It would have just slid off. My tray table was so slidey that even when I left the Switch on it flat and like moved about, the Switch would just start moving towards me. So there was no way in hell I was going to sort of get out of the kickstand.
So what you're telling me is that Nintendo false advertised the Nintendo Switch on a plane.
They really did. And apparently like they went beyond that, where they actually had fake planes within their Switch demonstration booths and things at events, where they'd have these mini planes where you could try it out on a tray table. It's like, nope. Like, the second you get any turbulence, and not even turbulence, like I said, my tray, it was just ever so slightly leaning towards me, so it was sliding off. Like, the number of tray tables like that don't actually sit perfectly flat is like the vast majority through my experience. So you're never
going to... Right, because planes are just janky as hell.
Planes are janky, they're old. Like, this is 2017 and I was flying on a 9-hour journey without a plug. Like,
yeah,
plane companies are just incredibly bad for having incredibly old fleets. And from my experience of listening to podcasts and my experience of US internal flights, they're actually much, much better than the majority of transatlantic flights when it comes to plug access. And don't even get started on like European flights within Europe, because they just never have plugs. They are considered like so short haul that you just don't have any plugs, even though Europe is not that much smaller than the United States. But there you go. It's weird.
It's priorities, man. Priorities. Those are what the priorities are.
So yeah, plugs on planes, absolute nightmare. But yeah. I should have a plug on the way back. We'll find out.
Hopefully you will, because then you can get a full how many hours it is out of Zelda.
Chunk of Zelda. That'd be
did the time fly by? Is also another question.
It completely flew by. I played it. Okay. So it was a 9-hour flight. I played it after about 4.5 hours. And I played it till my Switch died, and I was like, wow, that flew by. That was ideal. And like, time always flies by when you're playing Breath of the Wild.
Exactly, yeah.
And playing on a plane is no different. So I would highly recommend the experience for listeners out there, if you're making any flights or travel arrangements in the future.
Now, here's the thing, Bali. Your parents brought you the Switch case, but here's the real question. Did they bring your Wind Waker amiibo?
They did not, unfortunately.
Well, there you go. You're going to be missing out on the amazing...
I will be going back to Edinburgh before I return to Brussels, so I can pick it up then.
Great.
And enjoy the delights that amiibo can bring me in Breath of the Wild. So I look forward to that. Otherwise, what have I been playing? I beat a game on the Nintendo Switch.
Zelda, right? You beat Zelda? That's the game you beat?
I am so far from beating that game, it's not even funny. I beat Snipperclips with my girlfriend Caroline. And it
the other Nintendo Switch game that people should buy.
The other Nintendo Switch game that people really should buy. The second, like, if you have someone locally you can play it with, I'd highly recommend Snipperclips. So, all the people I'd heard talking about this, or who had tried it out in like demos and things, were all like, yeah, this game is great, it's such a good idea, it's really good. I tried the demo when the Switch came out and I really enjoyed it. I thought it was great. I think that ultimately the concept is incredibly strong, and for those who don't know what the concept is, essentially you're two cartoony characters made out of paper, and you have the ability to cut chunks out of each other, and then you're changing each other's shapes, and using those shapes you're interacting with each environment to manipulate the level and complete the puzzle. And
physics-based puzzles, as it would happen.
Physics-based.
This funny like parallel going with this game in Breath of the Wild.
Yeah, sure. And I love that there are just so many options to the ways that you can beat these crazy different levels. I believe there's, just before I try and work it out, I think there's 12 levels per world. And then it's actually a very short game. It's only 3 worlds. That's only about 36 to 40 levels, like as in 2-player co-op, which is very short. It only takes about 3 hours, like I said. And ultimately, that is too short. I think that is one fault of this game. But it actually worked out quite well for me and Caroline, because this game was making Caroline feel quite sick.
Which is really weird to say
I know.
For a 2D game. So but, you know, we have a history on this podcast
of
2D games making people sick, so let's continue the trend.
So, obviously, MVZ, you have a few issues with very specific things about certain video games making you sick. And this... How do I explain it? In the second and third world, I don't even think it's in the first world, and it's definitely worse in the second world than the third world. This is a 2D game, and essentially the 2D plane that you're looking at, the entire plane will just shift. It'll like wobble as like a visual effect. Now, obviously, the game's not like 3D, it's on Switch, but it kind of is suggesting it's like 3D, and every time it would wobble.
I think a nice way to explain that effect is, you know, when you're doing Smash Brothers and you move the C stick around and stuff angles.
Perfect.
I think it's kind of like that.
It's just like that, and ultimately, I actually think that games that go for stuff like that should maybe have just like a setting in the options that turn it off, because like, yeah. I'm confident it's the sort of thing that might make you feel a little bit uneasy about this. And like, as Caroline could get through it, but we were just playing very short play sessions, and that
right.
worked
and that's
out
the thing with
well.
Me with a lot of first person games. Like, I love Portal and Portal 2. I think they're incredible, but I can't play them for more than an hour at a time,
right?
Because I just, you know, I can't get through it. I'd be too sick. So,
or like, if you're
definitely the.
If Caroline's watching me play Zelda and then I start just hammering around on the camera with the right stick and swirling around the camera like you like to do at the end of Let's Play episodes, MBZ,
yes.
That sort of thing makes her sick as well. So like, it's just this,
okay.
It's a funny one, and it worked out. Like I said, it's only a 3-hour game, so we just over a series of maybe 6-8 short play sessions we beat it, and by playing it in short stints, she wasn't actually that ill. I think she was okay, but ultimately, I think it did affect how much she maybe enjoyed the experience.
Yeah, that's fair. You know, absolutely.
I think this concept, and I'm worried that I say this for every new puzzle game I play, but I really...
It's like you're just discovering something for the first time, and you're like, oh, yeah. It's the second coming of Christ.
I think this might be the most innovative yet, and maybe take that with a pinch of salt, because like I said, I have said that before about games like Box Boy and maybe The Swapper on this podcast, but once...
I would also not underestimate the multiplayer effect, right? Especially in person.
Sure.
I feel like people have better experiences and enjoy games more when they are playing with other people.
Yeah.
Like, it amplifies. Like, that's a lot of people talk about how Destiny had a lot of problems and was an issue. But people are like, I don't care. I'm playing it with my friends and I'm having fun, right?
Right.
Like, that's the thing that kind of gets you
and
along. But I do think that you're probably, you know, you're having fun for that reason, but it's also a very well-designed game.
Yeah, it's a very coupley game, I'm not going to lie. It's very, like, designed like, oh, we did it together, great, whatever.
I mean, like, one of the first levels you play, which is a part of the demo, which actually, side tangent, because I played the Snipperclips demo again, and the reason
nice.
Was because we were driving back from Glasgow, and me and my mum were in the back seat because my PC is so big, it takes up the entire front seat. And so... I basically popped the Switch down in the center of us, and because I'm kind of explaining the, you know, the system to her because she hasn't seen it before, and like, I hand her a Joy-Con. I'm like, okay, Mum, you're gonna play this with me. You're gonna play this thing. It's like, what is this? I don't know what to do. And you know, it's very much. I was trying to having to teach her how to use an analog stick at the same time as jumping, and you don't think about that as a thing that, you know, non-video game people have no idea what to do. But doing two things at once, like getting momentum in the air, like jumping at the same time as moving, is a very difficult thing.
Yeah.
If you don't have the concept. But yeah, so I was just playing through it with her, just through those demos, and she actually really enjoyed it. And she was like, "Oh, this is very cool and it was fun." I was like, "Wow, this is the first time you've played like a proper video game that isn't Wii Sports and actually somewhat enjoyed yourself." Oh, so I thought that was kind of an achievement.
Great.
But yeah, that was just my weird side tangent.
I really think that game has this power of just reaching out to people who haven't played a ton of video games. Like, Caroline hasn't played a ton of video games, and like, I'm obviously playing it with her, so I can just say, actually, maybe you should try this, maybe you should do this, and like, you're actually working cooperatively. So you're right, I think that does affect the enjoyment that someone can have playing a game. And it's a fantastic concept. I don't want to give away like really cool level design. I'm just going to say that in the final world, there's a lot of stuff to do with liquid that I really, really enjoyed. And I just thought that it was something I didn't really know about. And the variety of things this game makes you do with the mechanics it's offering you, I think, is far, far wider than other puzzle games I've played before. Like, obviously, stuff like Box Boy, Pool Blocks, Pushmo, Pool Blocks, whatever you want to call it. Those are very fixed sets of what you can and can't do.
Right.
The Swapper as well, like, it's a very fixed thing what you have to do. This is just, like you said, with the physics engine, MBZ, it's just opening it right up.
I think you can compare this to two games, which I think both of us have played a lot of. So one of them, obviously, Zelda, which has multiple solutions, and you feel like you can kind of do anything in that kind of physics sandbox. The other one is Trine 2, which I think is more analogous to this because it is also a 2D game, but you can kind of MacGyver solutions to your own liking. And, you know, maybe a little more limited in that game, but do you feel like there are comparisons to be drawn?
Yeah, definitely. I think that a game like Trine 2, they're still, with the mechanics they're offering you, I still think there's a smaller amount of things you can do compared to
There's more limitations.
There's more limitations, and that's mainly to do with the way that Snipperclips is designed. It's just really, really zany stuff that you've not seen in any of the demos or trailers or anything. Really zany stuff in the later two worlds that just really made me and Caroline be like, wow, that's like really cool. Like that is so different to what I was doing in the first world. And obviously they do repeat themes from the first world that repeat throughout the game, fine, but there's unique stuff that just keeps coming later in the game. And
is it a kind of Mario Galaxy sort of thing where they're throwing new ideas every level but then leaving them behind, or do they build on stuff as it goes on?
Some of them they leave behind and some of them they build on, and it's like it's a very nice combination. I think this game is incredible. It's not going to get top marks for me just because it's far too short. But maybe there's a lot of ideas they have left where there could be sequels and things like that. I think that there's so much room left in this. And there are a few mini games me and Caroline tried that were fine. They're take it or leave it. And I know that there's about a world and a half of four-player levels that I believe are just expanded versions of the two-player stuff. So that's cool as well if you've got the two Switches next to each other with four Joy-Cons that you can play together. So
very cool.
If I would highly recommend this game. I think every Switch should have it on it, just as that game where you can shove a Joy-Con in someone's hand, like you said, with your mum, MBZ, and say...
Yeah, I mean, that was the great thing about having that demo downloaded was, I want to show her this thing. Obviously, she doesn't give a rat's ass about Zelda, because she's like, you know, she was telling me in the car, like, I'm like, hey, mum, like, this is what video games can do. Sometimes they're like this and fun. And she's like, yeah, but like, all the things you do are just fucking weird, like running around with wizards and things. I'm like, okay, yeah, I mean... I do run around with wizards a lot, you're right.
You do enjoy that pastime, a bit of running around with wizards. It's just great, like, to open up the world of gaming to people who might not otherwise be interested. I think this is social lubricant, perhaps you could say. It's quite good for that, and I'm glad it's on the Switch. I'm glad it made launch. That's a crucial thing, I should say. Highly recommend it. Go play a bit of Snipperclips.
Yeah, I don't really have anyone around to play it with right now.
We
so
will.
That's
Let's play this game one day, and he said we will.
You're telling me. You keep telling me.
We will do it.
So yeah, sure. That sounds like fun. Bali, another thing that was huge that happened over the last... It was last week, wasn't it? Was the Splatoon Global Test Fire for Splatoon 2. And I know you played a lot of that as well.
Yeah, we both downloaded this. Same as last time with the test fires, we can't obviously play together. But they had a couple of maps. I think they had four or five slots over the weekend. We both did two each, I believe.
Yes.
And it was great. It was more Splatoon. In my view, it looked a little bit shinier. It felt slick. I enjoyed the new weapons they had on offer. I think the two maps they gave you were very bland. I don't know whether that was on purpose, just to make sure that you focused more on the mechanics and the new weapons and not think about your whereabouts. But I hope that they can implement some more interesting maps for the real game. I think that this was just like a window into the mechanics, and ultimately we're really not any more knowledgeable about the game modes that are going to be in this game, whether that's single player, the online game modes, and the other maps. And that's ultimately what I'm most intrigued about going forward, because this test fire, it sold me on the mechanics. I'm happy to get this game day one, but I'm intrigued to see what else they can do.
I mean, it's weird to say sold you on the mechanics, because, quite frankly, it's the exact same game as Splatoon 1 when it comes to that stuff.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah,
like, no, there it's obviously there are differences. You have the new special moves, which I thought were pretty cool. They felt more special, if you know what I mean, than the original game did. Where though
more
you
powerful.
Had like stuff which could be very effective. Yeah, I mean, the stuff in the first game was powerful, but like this feels more like, I don't know, maybe comparing to something like Overwatch, like a hero power or something that feels maybe a bit more tailored. Yeah, a bit more like tailored and unique, like the whole jetpack thing going up in the air and moving around. I think the roller special with the kind of slam to the ground is different, but more effective maybe than the giant squid just flopping everywhere, which, you know, it I like that, but it definitely had its, you know, its drawbacks. But generally, like, aside from the splat doolies, everything felt the exact same. And the more I look at this game, the more we kind of see of it, the less I'm convinced that this started out life as a true sequel. This was just going to be a deluxe edition. And the reason they put a 2 on it was because we need things that aren't just Wii U ports and Japan is going to, you know, eat this up, so we might as well put a sequel number on it. Like, not only because sequels sell better, but also because in Japan, Splatoon was a moneymaker like crazy, especially on Wii U, which had sold so little. And the thing that convinces me of that is you look at the matchmaking and you think about all the problems that the original Splatoon had with its lobby system and lack of loadouts and everything that operated with the online infrastructure. And it's the exact same. And I'm like, yeah, this just tells me that they haven't thought about rewriting any of that stuff. Like, that is the most bog standard. Like, you should be looking when you're an online game to improve the online experience. And everyone's like, oh, they can change it for the launch and everything. I'm like, no, this game is almost done. This is how they've tested it. And this is what it looks like. I am very doubtful that they're going to change this before launch. And I think that that is a crying shame. And a lot of people are like, well, clearly this is a sequel because, you know, you have these new things, you have these new maps. And I look at it and I'm like, okay, so if we're talking about shooters, generally, the market for them, that it's a very iterative genre, right? Like, you don't see these wild sweeping changes from game to game. And Nintendo has their fair share of genres where, or franchises where they don't have these wild sweeping changes. Things like Animal Crossing, things like Pokemon. And I think, for me, I expected them to be bolder with a sequel to Splatoon, to go further with it, to try stuff that was completely different, and the blueprint for me is still here. It's a great blueprint. Splatoon's a fucking amazing game, but ultimately, as Wii U owners, as people who have already played the first game for a lot of hours, I want to play this, but I feel like I'm being duped into playing something that isn't really a sequel, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, it's not dressed itself up well as a sequel so far, and I think that that's where you just will, mechanically you're right, the online is just the same, isn't it? We're just going to have to wait for the game modes and the single player mode and other new potential weapons. Like, will it really make the step up, or is this just a cash grab? And I think ultimately it's going to be a bit of both, to be honest. I think that there will be some cool game modes, and certainly after the update last time with Splatoon, where you could have like squad matches and squad battles and things like those worked well, and I'm intrigued to see how those might evolve with this game. But ultimately, I don't think the online before was particularly bad. Like, I think it matched up well, it worked well. I don't think, can you argue it didn't need massively updated?
I think it does need massively updated. I think the fact that you go into matchmaking and you can't change your weapon loadout on the fly
is
ridiculous.
Yeah, no, definitely. Yeah.
That stuff is absurd.
That is
quite
weird.
Frankly, like, you look at, and I know people like to compare Nintendo to other things, but like, when you are doing an online game, people have figured this shit out, and it's tedious because the way you stay in an online game is you have no friction, right? You want to be able to get in there and get out. And Splatoon, with its back out to the menu, change your thing, go back in, wait for it to connect, find a new lobby. And in other shooters, you're just in a lobby and you can do all that on the fly. You know, like, it keeps retention. And that's something that I think Nintendo are sometimes quite bad about, is like losing you over bad UI and menu design and things like that. So we'll see how that shakes out. But I think maybe one thing that I was interested, I don't know how you feel about it, is the lack of the gamepad and not having that bottom screen constantly and not being able to kind of shoot quickly to your teammates and not seeing the lay of the land. A lot of people were getting annoyed by the fact they changed the placement of the jump button. Also, most people playing the Splatoon 2 Global Test Fire have also been playing hundreds of hours of Zelda. So, and if they haven't changed the default controls, the jump button in that game is different. I was fine, frankly, because having played 100 hours of Zelda, going into Splatoon, the button was where I used to jump in Zelda because I switched them about. So it worked out fine for me. But I don't know if that was a problem for you, Bally, or if you feel that the loss of the gamepad is significant in any way to the second game.
I don't know how significant it is. Certainly in a mode like... I can't remember the name of the mode. What's the name of the mode where you...
Tower Control?
Not Tower Control. The main mode.
Splat Zones?
Not Splat Zones. The mode we played...
Turf War,
exactly. I think a lay of the land is very important for that mode, simply because it's about who covers most of the map in their own colored ink. So how do you know if you're winning or not? You look at the map and see who's covered the map in the most color of their ink, and having to press an extra button to see that is a little frustrating. I thought the teleportation fast travel sort of thing, squid jump thing, was a little more cumbersome than the game. Well, it's always going to be more cumbersome than the gamepad, and that's a shame. But it is as good as they could make it. They were always going to put Splatoon onto the Switch, and they were always going to lose the gamepad in this fashion. So it's expected. I don't know how they can work around it, but it obviously is a shame because Splatoon was designed with the gamepad in mind, and now there's no gamepad, so how do they evolve from that? And it's not ideal.
Yeah, I personally don't think it's, you know, a game breaker or anything.
No,
it's,
not at all.
It's annoying, but it's not... It doesn't really significantly change the way that you play that game. The one thing that did annoy me was when you open it, you have to press X and then X again to close it. Why can't you just press B to close it? It's just one of these things that really annoys me, is in my gamer brain, when I want to back out of something, I always press B, and it just doesn't do that. So I'm like, God damn it. Just, it's one of those UI things that really just gets on my nerves.
It's the way you're programmed.
Exactly. And I guess, you know, playing Zelda had to reprogram all that shit anyway. But yes, I don't know. Is there anything else we need to say? I think, you know, there weren't really many connection issues I had with Splatoon 2. It worked fine.
I've heard about others having very bad connection issues. It was fairly smooth for me as well. It worked well.
Yeah, and apparently, you know, people were trying it over data connections on their phones, and that seemed to be okay. So there is a possibility, if you for some reason have a lot of internet available through your network provider on your phone, you can be on the road in a car playing Splatoon 2. You know, that seems pretty damn cool. So I'm glad that, you know, it's possible. Maybe we should actually quickly talk about playing on the gamepad on the Switch. God damn it, Pally. It really is Wii U syndrome, like being stuck. But playing it on the Switch screen itself, for me, that was a worse experience. And I don't know what it is about moving a second analog stick on a handheld, but I felt like I was clawing the controller a bit more when it was off the TV. And I don't know how you feel about that.
Yeah, perhaps. When I was in handheld mode, I was using the second analog stick less because I was using the gyro. And I actually thought that taking the tablet out itself.
The Switch tablet.
Taking the Switch tablet out itself with the Joy-Cons attached, I was worried wouldn't work well at all with the gyro because you're twisting it around. But actually, it kind of worked better than I thought it would. I definitely agree with you. I preferred it when it was on the screen and I just had the Joy-Cons in the Joy-Con grip and I was able to use all my motion control like that. I thought that worked well. But it looks so damn crisp on the Switch tablet, doesn't it? It looks so...
Oh, boy.
It looks so great. So, I mean, I will be able to play this on the go, but I'll just try and play it on my screen more often than not.
Yeah, it makes sense.
That's coming summer, we know. That's all we know.
Yeah, so it is.
Just after E3, just before.
I would say July, maybe, where I'm guessing it's possible. July's a weird place to release something, though. I don't know. It's this weird conundrum where it's like, where does ARMS go now? Is ARMS a May game? Because Mario Kart's end of April.
Yeah, I reckon ARMS end of May.
Yeah, ARMS probably end of May, which leads us into E3. Maybe end of June for Splatoon, maybe. That could potentially be it. But then you're thinking about what else is covering those gaps. I don't know. We're talking about it like month at a time sort of thing. That Fire Emblem Warriors game is probably coming around September or something, or October. So, they may have enough big games coming out each month to where it works like that.
I wonder if Nintendo are kicking themselves to just put the development of that game onto the Switch for Fire Emblem.
You mean the Musou, the Dynasty Warriors game?
No, the one you just said that's coming to 3DS.
I was talking about the Dynasty Warriors game, because the one that's coming.
Okay. Right, yeah. Got you.
But I don't think Nintendo actually do care about that, because they still want to use that 3DS Fire Emblem engine. They've made four fucking games in it already.
Yeah,
why not do another?
It's the whole engine. You can't just move it.
And they're also creating a ground-up Fire Emblem for Switch anyway for next year. So I think they're fine. So that's Splatoon 2, Global Test Fire. I'm sure a lot of you played it as well, but it's good. Look, it's a good game. It's going to be fun. Probably going to be the first time where a lot of us are actually kind of checking the online out for Nintendo Switch, and I wonder how that stuff's going to roll out with this voice chat and this app.
Oh boy.
Seems weird. So I've also been playing some other things, Bally. Finished
Zelda.
The Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild.
Never heard of it.
I think we're going to do an episode where we just go full hog on this thing. I think we have to. I think we owe it to people. I think we owe it to ourselves to talk about this game at length. And I have no idea when you're going to finish it, but we promise you we'll do a spoiler cast. And I hope that will happen sooner rather than later, because when we did our Xenoblade one, that took us forever to get around to. But I think Zelda's probably a more important thing, especially with it being more fresh on the mind. I'll say that after playing that game for over 100 hours, having gotten every shrine, having done a majority of the side quests, and having beaten all the main story, it's one of the best games I've ever played. And I think that's, it may be an overstatement. I think there are a lot of best games I've ever played on the history of doing this podcast. I think Ori and the Blind Forest is one of the best games I've ever played. I think Chrono Trigger is one of the best games I've ever played. I think Persona 4 Golden is one of the best games I've ever played, and that's great, but there is something about this that feels a bit more above even that tier. I don't know. I need some distance from it.
It's almost like we're going to have to do another top 50 Nintendo games of all time, MBZ.
Maybe, yeah. that could be an interesting thing to do.
And I mean, I guess we're going to have to do another top games of the year as well.
Yeah, I guess so. So we'll talk about that when it comes to that time. I thought it ends very strong, and I was pretty satisfied with what goes down in the end of that game. And I know a lot of you have been playing it and have maybe finished it by now, but get on that and finish that up, and then go and listen to people talk about it, because I've been listening to I had a playlist on YouTube of my Watch Later, obviously, which is fucking 280 videos long, because I'm so behind.
Because that's
going
to get watched later.
later meaning in 7 years. I had a whole string of Zelda videos that I was like, I've got to go back and watch this when I'm done. And now I'm done, it feels great to be able to, I can run around without fear of any spoilers. So
that's nice.
Good times.
Yeah.
It is nice. And so quickly before we end, I wanted to talk about a couple of games that I never got to talk about because Zelda happened at a time when we were recording the podcast, 3 days after the Switch. So I had finished Castlevania Dawn of Sorrow and Persona 3 Portable that week because I was trying to beat things before Zelda came out and ended up not talking about either of them. So I'll quickly just go through these, but did I talk about Castlevania Dawn of Sorrow at all on this podcast?
And we said, I talk about so many Castlevania games, they just blend into one in my mind, I'm afraid.
I know, I realize.
I struggle. Their names sound so similar as well. I struggle.
Well, in this case, literally like one word difference because the GBA one that I played at the start of this year was Aria of Sorrow. This is Dawn of Sorrow. Now, here's the thing, Bally, though. You should be able to tell why it was named Dawn of Sorrow, because this came out at the start of the DS era, in a time when every DS game had something with D and S in its title. So Advance Wars Dual Strike, Castlevania Dawn of Sorrow, all these different games coming out. And so this is, it's weird, because this is the first Castlevania game in the Metroid kind of lineage that has played as a direct sequel to another one. And that's obvious from the title, because they're both called Sorrow, Aria and Dawn of Sorrow. But you're playing as the same character, Soma Cruz. And this one's weird, because you kind of open, and it's not necessarily a castle. It's more like this hideout that you go to. And it's all in the snow, and it's outside, and it's modern day, and there are cars and vans, like, in the snow. And I remember, like, at the very start of this game, you're kind of going down this central area, and you land on top of a car. And it's got this really nice animation of, like, snow just, like, shifting from the top of this, like, van onto the floor. And it's very different aesthetically. So as soon as I started, I was like, oh, this is a nice kind of change of pace. Because all these games, one of the things I think I've complained about a lot going through these is you always see the same types of areas again and again, like the clock towers and the libraries and the cathedrals. Like, they're not necessarily copy and pasted, but you know that that area is going to show up and that area is going to show up. It's kind of ticking the boxes. And so it was a nice surprise to start this game and be like, oh, this is a little different. They're trying something new. And inevitably, there are still areas that you go and you find that are similar. But that kind of just stood out to me to begin with. I think the thing that really stands out most about this game is you can smell the original DS a mile away, in the sense that this is definitely during the era where everyone was trying to use the DS's touchscreen as some sort of thing within the game, even when it doesn't seem like it's needed. So in some ways that I think are really cool, in some ways are fucking garbage. So let's talk about the cool thing first. There are areas where there are these ice blocks, and there'll be these giant kind of walls of ice, and you use the touchscreen to kind of tap away at the ice so you can kind of create your own path through it. It's almost like you're in Rayman Legends when you use the second character. You know, like sometimes you're drawing a path through different sand areas and stuff like that. It feels like that, where you're kind of drawing this path for you to go. But instead of, you know, your character moving on their own, you have to control Soma while you're going through these stuff. So it leads to some neat puzzles where there's this one where you're standing on this moving platform and you have to tap at these ice blocks as the moving platform moves you across the screen. And then you have to just jump off right in time before the end. And I like that stuff. I think that's actually really neat. And it's a unique way of implementing the touchscreen in a way that serves the platforming and the exploration of the game. And that was very cool. The bad stuff is really fucking bad. Every time you beat a boss, you have to draw a symbol on the screen as if you're banishing them, right? Like, you're kind of exorcising them from the world, right? And so every time you enter, you'll learn new symbols from different places, and you enter one door, and it kind of draws it for you. And it goes so fast that, like, knowing the start point and the end point is something you really have to be cognizant of. If you just look at the shape and you don't know where it begins and where it ends, you're going to be fucked, because you have to start at the right place and end at the right place every time you do it. So it starts off pretty easy, and it's like, oh, just a triangle or whatever, like, very simple. And so every time you get the boss down and it's almost dead and you kill it, and then it pops up on the screen, do this symbol. So you do it, and then they die. If you fuck it up, the boss doesn't come back to life fully, but regains maybe 25% of their HP. So if you fuck this up, they start coming alive again. You get one chance at this once you've killed them, right? And so by the end of the game, these symbols are getting really fucking complicated and stressing me out. Like, it's not stressful enough just to fight a boss that you're trying to beat. And
you better already be holding that stylus.
Exactly. It's like, oh shit, I need to fucking grab for my stylus at the end of this fight. And I get there and I fuck it up. I'm like, God fucking damn it. Like, I've already proved, game, I've fucking proved that I can beat this boss and I've done it. The fact that there is this extra stupid step that has never been in any other Castlevania game and has no fucking reason to be in here aside from, hey, the DS has a touchscreen and we want to be fucking gimmicky about it. It just infuriated me. I was like, God damn it. Like, it's really hard to go back to old games sometimes, but I think it's way harder to go back to periods of time where things were shoved into games for the sake of that era, right? And so the early DS era has a lot of bullshit in it, and this is one of those examples.
Yeah, it's kind of fun to look back on now. That's just how it is in history forever. Like that group of DS games that just have these random things thrown in where we can look back and think, you know what, that was a really dumb idea.
But it was one of those things at the time where I think people... I mean, I probably would have found it cool because I was really into that stupid shit when I was a kid. I fucking loved really dumb touchscreen things. But, you know, playing this more traditional game, which is fusing in those elements, it's never a good idea, I feel. And, it wasn't great. But I think overall, this game is really good. And I think it actually has a kind of level of control and movement about it that was... It felt better to play than Aria of Sorrow did, which was a little weird, but I don't necessarily think it's that much better than that game. I think if we're just talking about raw, like, map design and going through places, I'd say they're probably on par. Maybe I would give it to Aria just because it doesn't have this touchscreen stuff in it. But Dawn of Sorrow does a lot of interesting things. I think it is, aesthetically, it definitely stands apart from the stuff I've played so far. So that was definitely a more positive impact. They definitely have more of a focus on narrative in this game. There's way more text and characters talking and all that shit than has ever been in one of these before. And I don't really care about it because it's just the same shit every time. Dracula's back. Oh no, there are bad people and fucking, you know, it's your Castlevania story. Who gives a shit? It's not what I'm there for. So, I finished that. That was good. And then I finished Persona 3 Portable, which, man...
Is that actually what it's called? Persona 3 Portable?
Yeah, right, because the original Persona 3 came out on PlayStation 2, and then there was an updated version of it called Persona 3 FES, or Fez, and then they brought it to PSP. So, it's just the PSP
the word
version...
Portable in the name is very strange. It's like, imagine if Ocarina of Time 3D was just called Ocarina of Time Portable or something.
Yeah.
Like, it's just a strange, strange thing. Anyway.
I think Persona gets away with it because of the... not alliteration. Is it alliteration? Portable?
I mean, PSP
Portable?
Is PlayStation Portable, so I can understand like why...
Yeah, no, you're right. That's why they called it Portable, because it's PlayStation Portable, right, exactly. Yeah. You're 100% correct. It's like the DS thing that we just talked about, you know, just put the name of the system in the name of the game. Anyway.
3D in Ocarina. Anyway, yes.
Yes. So I did talk a bit about Persona 3 and my first impressions and stuff a while ago on the show. Having finished it, it left me feeling a little hollow inside, mainly because I think I was trying to drive through it and trying to beat it quickly, which is not a great idea with those kind of games. But the thing with Persona 3 is it feels like a blueprint. It feels like this was them figuring it out. And by the time you get to Persona 4, the blueprint has been figured out. They have nailed every fucking aspect. And it is just a glorious thing. It is perfectly designed and just has all this character and warmth to it and all that stuff. And I think there is a little bit of a detachment to Persona 3. It's more of a darker game. It's definitely a darker story. And I didn't attach myself to the characters as much, which was definitely the thing about Persona 4 that everyone says is these are like some of the best characters in video games, full stop. like some of my favorites, most memorable, just amazing stuff that goes on with them. And 3 feels like they have more archetypical elements to them. They're still really good characters. Like, they're better than a lot of other video games. But when you're in the Persona series, you have a lot to compete with, right? So just being good isn't good enough. And it's hard because I'm playing this game after I've already played the thing that it's improved on. But I'm glad it exists because it needed to exist for the series to blossom and to grow its wings and to go to where it is now. And that is something that I think a lot of games, we talk about things like the original Legend of Zelda and how it's hard to go back and play that thing now, but you can't deny the blueprint and the importance of that blueprint.
Yeah,
because
definitely.
Without it, you don't have Link to the Past and you don't have Ocarina of Time. So I totally understand where people are coming from on Persona 3. And if it's your first experience with the series, I'm sure it kind of blows you away, especially because of the time it was made and all that stuff. But yeah, I don't know. It's hard to articulate, but there was just a bit of a level of detachment there. It also annoyed me that I was playing on the easiest possible difficulty, and yet I still had to spend a lot of time grinding. And I think the problem there is this game has a bad balance of combat and grinding to story and character. Where Persona 4, I could kind of hang out with people and do as much of that as I wanted. And when I did the dungeons, I knocked out the dungeons in a one shot and didn't have to worry about them. And I was kind of leveled up as I needed to be. Whereas here, it was a balance that it gave into the side that I dislike more about this series. I still think it's a good game. I still think it's very good, but it was held back by a lot of things. So I finished that, and I've now played 8 hours of Persona 5, which isn't out for 2 more days, Bally, but UK retailers don't give a fuck and ship things early. And I'll talk about Persona 5 probably later, because great. 8 hours of that game is not enough. But let me say, so far, that thing has some fucking style, man! Giant Bomb's Best Style Award, lock it in right now. Persona 5 wins it. Easy. No fucking competition. So, I think that's it. We went a long time talking about all those video games, but we had a lot of things to cover.
Quite a lot of video games. Bit of catch-up in the vacuum that was Zelda Breath of the Wild.
Absolutely. Needed to happen. I'm glad it did. And that's going to be us for this segment, but don't go anywhere because we'll be back right after the break with some of your emails. You never see it coming.
And welcome back to the show of this episode 89 of This Nintendo Life Part 2. Part 2 means it's time for emails. 2 segments show this week. But before I get onto the emails, I should really say the email address, which of course is thisnintendolife@gmail.com. That's thisnintendolife@gmail.com. Please send us more emails. We love it when you send in your emails and it gives us a nice selection of questions that we can dip into and create some interesting discussions. So,
absolutely.
Our first email is from Colin H, who's from the internet. Hello, MBZ and Bally. It's been a while since I've written to you, and I hope everything is going well. It is. Thanks, Colin. On to my question. Ever since I got my Switch, I have been wanting to take it on the go and bring it places. However, it seems that there really isn't anywhere I can bring my Switch that's socially acceptable. Going to a park where there would presumably be kids would seem creepy because I am a 26-year-old man. I take public transportation to work, but I'm really worried if I bring it, someone will jump me and take it. I've thought about taking it with me to a cafe to play, but remember that I live in Washington, D.C. The people that go to cafes here are ones that read their Wall Street Journals, Washington Post, and talk about Dostoevsky while sipping a nice red wine. Taking my Switch from my living room and crawling with it in bed is great and all, but it seems because of these societal norms, I will forever be forced to do just that. With gaming becoming more mainstream, why does the stigma of playing video games in public still exist? Do you think that there will ever be a time where I will be free to play my Switch wherever without judgment? I really would like to have a feeling whatever precedes the Switch will also have the same gimmick. MBZ, you mentioned once that you were playing your 3DS in a bar because you weren't interested in watching the soccer game that was on the TV. Did you feel weird playing or felt judged while doing so? Do either of you two have advice for people feeling the same way that I am? Thanks again, Colin.
Well, thank you, Colin, for that question. It's a really interesting one, and one that I think we can dig into quite a bit. So, will there ever be a time when you can go outside in public and play a video game? The answer is yes, it's right
now.
Because mobile games exist. Right. If you want a cynical way to look at it. It is that weird thing, right? Where people on the trains will bring out their phone and no one judges them because the phone is this multifaceted device where you don't really know what someone's doing unless you're looking over their shoulder, right? Like someone holding up their phone could be reading a Kindle book. They could be browsing the internet. They could be sending a text. Gaming is just one of those things that could possibly be happening. And yet we know hundreds of thousands of people, if not millions of people, are doing that. But I feel like that's probably not in the spirit of this question, right? I just wanted to bring that up because I think that's an interesting thing.
There is a distinction, and what is the distinction? Obviously, someone, not in all cases, but in most cases, someone who is playing, say, a Switch, a 3DS, a PSP, a Vita, whatever you want to call it, has invested more money into that particular video game than someone who's playing Candy Crush. And I say in most cases,
it's not only just investing more money into the game, it's literally buying a device that is dedicated to do just that.
And that's seen as like, wow, you're a gamer, like you're really into games. But whereas playing a mobile game for perhaps like 8 hours of Candy Crush every day, you're not a gamer, you're just someone who plays games. And like, there is still a distinction, and it's very difficult. I mean, something like the Wii, everyone who owned a Wii would, I'm sure there are plenty of people who owned a Wii who wouldn't call themselves gamers, and if you gave them that label, they'd be like, I'm not a gamer, I just own the Wii, I play Wii Sports, that's like what I do. There's like this really strange distinction between the two. I guess if someone's on public transit watching a film, whether that's on a tablet or a laptop or something, I don't think there's any stigma, is there? Like, it's very...
No, there's none at all.
Specifically video games, and...
And I think that's because of the nascency of the industry, right? Like, the very idea that someone would be called a movie person or a buff. There are movie buffs out there, right? But that's a very different thing. Everyone watches films. Everyone watches television. Everyone listens to music. Like, these are things that have penetrated the mainstream. And because of that, there is no label associated with it. So that's why you can be someone watching a film on your iPad, whereas if you have a device that is just for playing games, this entire thing is bound up with the label of being someone who plays games, right? That is the ultimate issue here. The societal norm exists because the societal group of the gamer exists still as a thing.
Yeah. And my own personal experience was, while I was at school and I was younger, sort of up until the age of 18, I was very conscious of like playing video games and being seen to play a lot of video games, and I wouldn't want to be
self-conscious
seen...
to the point where you deleted an entire YouTube channel because of the idea of you playing Pokemon would potentially get out to people.
Exactly. And it was just it was a stigma I was scared of. It was like, everyone's just going to think I play video games. It's like, well, I do play video games, so why should I be scared of that? But ultimately, when you're still formulating who you are, it, for me at that point in time, it felt like too much. But the second I was at university and I like discovered who I was, I guess you could argue, and I'm very comfortable in what I do with the podcast and the amount I play video games, and I enjoy telling people about it who are interested, and if they want to judge me and say, oh, you're a video gamer or you play too many video games, then they're allowed to judge. I'm a lot more confident in and of myself to play games in public, to talk about the podcast, to talk about what I do and talk about how much I enjoy it and I feel this passion for it. And that's something that's definitely changed since I was younger. I should say I'm now 25 and that was when I was 18, so I have definitely changed quite a lot in that time. I don't know, how do you feel, MBZ?
Yeah, I think it's definitely an age thing, right? It's a fear. It's all bound up with the bullshit of school, right? It's just
everyone
has to put on a face because no one can really be themselves because there are cliques and, you know, all this bullshit and people will, things will spread, you know, the whole idea of like stuff spreading across the campus and everything, you know, that's just very, it's very cliche, but it's also kind of true, you know, it's in a bad way. And, you know, we have the examples of, you know, our friend Ali T and the Pokemon team thing. And, you know, there was this one time when we were walking up to chapel and Ali T and me were just fucking bitching at each other because of whatever reason. And Ali T was just saying out loud something about like, oh, you know what Nan does on his weekend? He fucking plays Mario and Luigi Dream Team. Out loud to everyone. I was like, and I just didn't really say anything. And then one of my other friends was like, the sadder thing is that you know what he does on his weekends. So I shut Ali T up. So that was hilarious. But, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, I wasn't very overt about the fact that I was really deep into games.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
there's always people having these conversations about, you know, gamers. I think the term gamer became a very loaded and very negative thing, like to be derogatory at school even. Even though people were playing fucking CSGO in third form and all that stuff. And I think it's maybe more with Nintendo, actually. I think it's actually much more to do with the idea of the perception of Nintendo as a more child-friendly platform, as a more younger platform, the idea that you would play something like a Pokemon or a Mario or whatever one of their franchises would be looked down on more. And I think that was very much for us because we were so deep into Pokemon. I think it all really stems back to that, you know, the trading card stuff back when we were in prep school. That stuff was big forever, and then everyone kind of, you know, got out of the fad. And, like, fads existed for however long. And then, of course, you know, they disappeared and people left them behind. But, you know, that's the sort of thing that we kept doing. And so as a result, you feel the necessity to not talk about it. So that was definitely something that I think kind of is a through line that has come from that point and has continued to go forward.
And it was funny because, like, I was on a flight with Caroline just a few weeks ago, and I had obviously brought my Switch and I was planning to play some Zelda, and she was sitting next to me and she felt a bit like uncomfortable that she, like, she was with me and that I was playing Zelda on a plane, and I was like, honestly, I feel completely comfortable about this, why do you feel uncomfortable? And she's just like, I don't know, it's just a bit weird. I'm like, I feel comfortable playing Zelda here, I don't have to hide that, like I'll do it. And like I think the answer to your question, Colin, is just play your video games whenever you feel comfortable to play them. I certainly agree with you that maybe if I was in a bar with like friends watching football or something, I wouldn't want to just get out my Switch randomly and start playing it, but maybe I don't know, if I was by myself I might. If I was by myself and not interacting with others, I'd happily do it. But I think just wherever you feel comfortable. I mean, you're 26, Colin. You're same age as us. You know, you are who you are, and if people don't want to accept that, then that's up to them. But it shouldn't affect your own actions ultimately. If you're comfortable in playing video games, as I'm sure you are, then just play them.
Yeah, and I think the thing that happened with me is I decided to not give a shit. And as soon as that happened, everything dissipated. Like, I was just telling people, yeah, I just do this fucking Pokemon YouTube channel. Like, I just don't really. And like, but the thing with that is interesting is also because at the time I could say, oh yeah, also I get paid for doing this. And yeah. I was like, it's sort of a moment of pride almost. It's like, yeah, I play video games and get paid to do it, which was very interesting.
Yeah.
And that maybe helped to spur that on somewhat. But, you know, it's also this idea of, well, you know, there are these people in this bar, and I'm so it's the thing with watching the football game is I was just with my dad or whatever, and he, you know, we're just out in town, he wants to get a beer and go watch the football. I don't really give a fuck because I don't want to watch football, so I just pop out my 3DS, start playing Shovel Knight because why not. And anyone in that bar, they're focusing on the football, they're not watching me, they don't care what I'm doing, I'm just sitting there having, I've got a fucking beer next to me. I'm never going to see these people ever again. And my dad realizes that I'm just, we're going to chill here, play this 3DS, and we'll have a bit of a chat at the same time. You know, it's not really a big issue. And then I think even bigger than that was me going to the gym playing my 3DS.
Right.
Certainly, at the gym, there are all these university students, and they're all training, all this stuff. And I'm just I'm fucking holding up to my face, cycling on this thing in the center of the room. Like, the people could be looking at
that
me.
That is
thinking,
bold. I love that.
Yeah, I literally don't give a fuck because I don't know any of these people. That. I'm never going to talk to any of these people, probably. Although university is weird about that because there's lots of... You'll run into people, essentially. Yeah. But that said, you know, the inhibition is gone. I literally couldn't care less. So that's how I decided.
But like, just... we talk about these societal norms. Like, the way we change these societal norms is by the people who enjoy playing video games and want to play those video games in public by playing those video games in public. That's how we're going to change societal norms. And if everyone who enjoys video games on the go wants to play them in public, then in 5, 10, 20 years' time, that's when everyone will be like, oh yeah, everyone just plays video games in public. That's just what people do. And it's maybe... it can be, it was originally associated with a younger audience, but as we know, video game audiences have been getting older and older because those first people who played video games are getting older now. So like the age, average age of people playing video games when Pokemon Red and Blue came out was far younger than it is now. And like, it's just a case of changing the societal norms. And I think it is getting there slowly. And I still think that adults playing video games in public is far more socially acceptable now than it was 5-10 years ago. Especially, definitely, I would argue in the UK. I don't know about maybe other areas of the world, but that will change and keep changing and getting better. And you just have to be confident in yourself and just, like you said, Emmy, it doesn't matter. These people around you, you don't have to talk to them. You have to interact with them. You're just doing what you're doing. It's just be who you are.
Yeah. That's probably the best way to go about it. It's interesting because I think we have an example where this kind of stigma has already been pushed to the side, and that is Japan, where it's perfectly natural for people to be playing video games all the time everywhere. You know, they're a very mobile-focused society now, and, you know, handhelds have maybe fallen off. But I remember, you know, whenever people would talk about going to Japan on video game podcasts and things like that, they would all say on the train, they would see people playing PSPs or DSs or all that stuff. Like, it was just a natural thing that people had with them all the time. And I think that we will probably get to that place in other regions as well.
And I guess the success of the Switch is quite important to this argument. Like,
sure.
This is all tied.
To be quite frank, the Switch is basically the last bastion for gaming handhelds.
Is mobile gaming going to take over? Or, like, is the Switch replacing the 3DS? Is it the successor, etc.? Like, this is massively interlocked with, arguably, in terms of gaming in public, handheld gaming, and where that goes in the future. But definitely the stigmas we've been talking about are massively associated with home console gaming as well. It's just handheld gaming is obviously where those things are more public and more out in the open. So, yeah, it's an interesting one, and I'm sure it'll change so much in the future, so much. So our next email is from Ryan, who's from Colorado. Dear MBZ and Bally, with the Switch launch upon us, it looks like this is going to be a similar situation to the Wii, Wii U, Amiibo, and GameCube controller adapters, where they are sold out immediately and don't restock for months. To make matters worse, scalpers try and sell these online for outrageous prices. What do you think would help combat scalpers? I think having more initial stock of these products could help to mitigate the problem by forcing scalpers to buy more copies and take a bigger risk if they want to control the prices. However, this puts Nintendo at risk too, because they might not sell everything if they make more copies. Thanks, Ryan from Colorado.
Ah, scalpers. We hate them.
It's a tough one.
We don't love them. I was going to say we hate them, we love them. It's like, no, we don't love them at all.
We don't love them.
Scalpers are pretty much the worst. But also, I totally understand why they exist, because if you want to be a person who is, you know, entrepreneurial, perhaps, maybe it's a little bit going too far to say scalpers are entrepreneurial, but that's where the basis of the idea comes
from,
right?
It's like, money, yeah.
I'm going to buy stuff cheap, sell it for profit,
right,
make money in the process. And this definitely is a scenario that can only really be combated, in my opinion, by having more stock than it is possible for the scalpers to sell on and make money on because it's readily available, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the problem with that is that Nintendo have traditionally been very conservative about this stuff. And I think a lot of people take the stance that Nintendo deliberately constrains
right.
supply, and I don't know how true that is, because I hear
that's
other people, especially
one.
Nowadays, talking about how it's not necessarily that Nintendo want to constrain supply, because, man, they would love to sell a billion NES classics, right? But it's more to do with the fact that they don't want to have product in the market that then doesn't go anywhere, right? They don't want
right.
to have extra inventory left over, which is sitting in a warehouse not making any money,
and
which puts them at a back foot and therefore doesn't get them kind of selling things out and looking good, right?
I guess this could the reasons why they might be more conservative in the batches they make. Look at something like the Joy-Con issue. Obviously, that didn't become like a mass recall. And it's become like a voluntary send your Joy-Con, your left Joy-Con to Nintendo. They fix it and send it back. Say that had been like a genuine mass default and they were doing mass recalls. Like, they have conserved money by doing a batch, seeing how it's done. And then in case they had to make some sort of adjustment, they can change that for the next batch and not have to do an even bigger recall than they would have had done. So the risk for something like that is certainly minimized. Whether that's a big argument in their overall argument of, and you know, the debate of whether they purposely hold back stock is a huge
right.
one that I certainly don't know the answer to, but that might be a factor if there is some sort of deliberate reduction in stock.
Yeah, that's a very good point you bring up about the Joy-Con stuff. Because, I mean, there was the thing with Microsoft where the Xbox 360 had the red ring problem. And, Jesus, they had a lot of those that had to be recalled because they had made so many and then people had the issue. And that became like a kind of mass hysteria almost. But that is, I think, again, that's something that, especially when we're coming to launch for a product, that makes a lot more sense, right? Because with launch, you always have problems. Like, hardware is new. It's just coming out, you know, first production line. There are going to be duds. And that happens
right.
with everything. Like, it's funny because you see these videos on YouTube of like, oh, the Switch, and it shows it in the worst light possible because everyone who has an issue uploads a video to YouTube about their stupid issue, and you see all these, and it looks like there's this overwhelming amount, but in reality, there's probably about maybe, I don't know, a few hundred that are defective out of 2 million, and percentage-wise, that's incredibly low.
But they
you
take
always
up the
have, yeah, they do, because that's just the way the internet works.
Right.
It's, you know, everyone kind of it was the big thing about Assassin's Creed Unity. I think it's happening around Mass Effect Andromeda right now. I don't think everyone's going to be getting these ridiculous bugs, maybe more people than usual, but like the people who are getting them are being like, oh my God, look at this crazy fucking thing. It's terrible. And it gets amplified because of the noise of the internet, right? And I think that's probably a case with, you know, defective stuff as well. But I guess back to the point of combating scalpers, it's, I think really it has to be done on the retail side more than anything. It's places like Amazon saying you can only buy one copy. And that's tough to police because people don't really have a limit on creating multiple accounts.
And it's tough for Amazon because they want to make money.
Exactly. They want to sell their product, right? They want to get it out there. And, you know, they could feel like, oh, we could have fucking scalped them ourselves being Amazon. Of course, they're not going to do that because, you know,
it's too big for Amazon to be of interest to try and do what a scalper would do. And ultimately, there are still people who sell through Amazon that do scalp. This is just ultimately, I would see it as just a bit of a flaw in capitalism, arguably.
Let's go down to the root of the problem. Let's get ideological for a second.
I think it's supply and demand at different levels. And when you have a great big company like Nintendo and a great big company like Amazon, and Nintendo says, right, we're making this many Switches, and Amazon says, right, we'll sell this many. You've not given us enough. And then someone who wants to make a large profit at a very local, smaller level can just buy a handful of Switches and sell them at a markup. I think that's just... Yes, there are forces you can do within the market that can mitigate it that I guess we've been through, but ultimately that is just part of free market capitalism and how you buy and sell goods.
And the thing is, I think scalpers only have power because of people's own desperation to have something as soon as possible, right? And it's hard to say... you get rid of that because everyone has their own needs and wants, right? Like, I think both of us would be in a very tough position if we couldn't get a Switch day one, because, you know, obviously we have this podcast to do and talk about it, but we're also really big fans of Nintendo and want to play Zelda on the best possible platform. And that is tough because me personally, I have emotional investment in that, and then the scalper's kind of taking advantage of it, which I can't really do anything about. And it's basically the thing that scalper's greatest enemy is time, and I think we see this with Amiibo, where the Amiibo bubble happens and everyone's going fucking crazy over it. Little Max is selling for 50 quid and Rosalina's a 70, and this markup is ridiculous, and Nintendo eventually flood the market with new product, people start getting more disinterested. Guess what? I can go and buy a Roy Amiibo for like 7 or 6 quid on Amazon. There are Amiibos for like 5 or 4 or 3. Like, they're very low prices. And at this point, no one's scalping Amiibo because there's no reason to. They're so cheap at this point that it's completely disappeared. So essentially, how do you beat scalpers?
Don't be so damn desperate.
Right, essentially.
And see, we're hypocrites for saying that, because we are desperate. We want a Switch, and I was prepared to pay quite a lot of money for a Switch day one, and I think I paid more than perhaps a lot of people in the US did just because of buying it from a retail shop in Belgium, in Brussels. But that's just life. My flaw is that I wanted it day one, no matter what. And if they want to make more money off me as a result, it's just what I have to live with. And if you've got an entire Amiibo collection and it cost you about $5 million because you wanted it day one, then I guess you shouldn't have been so damn keen to get a complete Amiibo collection day one. But at the same time...
That's where I come down on it, though, with Amiibo especially, is... I can understand someone wanting a Switch day one because Zelda is a video game. There is something you can do with Zelda. An Amiibo is a thing that sits on a shelf.
Right, but there are people outside of video games who see something like Zelda as being just as unnecessary in your life, arguably, yeah. as an ornament. And they're right. wrong for saying that, because I share the same opinion as you, MBZ. I freaking love Zelda. I want a Switch day one, but I don't care about Amiibo getting it day one or whatever. So yeah, everyone's needs and wants are different, but I totally get what you're saying.
I find it so difficult to figure out why someone has to have that Amiibo, so they because, have to have it on their shelf. It's just
capitalism has driven people crazy.
Yep. should be the title of this episode.
Capitalism has driven the world crazy.
Oh God. All right.
So our final question this week is from Joseph, who's from Kentucky. Hello, greetings from Kentucky, United States. It's a shit place. Don't ever come here, but if you do, you guys are welcome to crash with me. Great. Thanks, Joseph. I wanted to hear a discussion from you guys on how biased gamers can be. For example, I know since we are all Nintendo fans and Nintendo basically only releases exclusives, we all play genres of games that we might not normally play, simply because they're released on the Nintendo console. More specifically, games like Yoshi's Woolly World or Star Fox are not games that I normally would play if they were released on Steam or PlayStation. Do you guys think that you play genres of games that you wouldn't otherwise play only because it's released on a Nintendo console? For me, I like to give the games the benefit of the doubt and try them since they're released on a Nintendo console. There are a ton of games that are released on PlayStation or Steam that are similar to Nintendo games that I would never in a million years try. In that case, it seems somewhat biased. I just wanted to get your thoughts. Thank you. Thanks, guys. Joseph.
Well, Joseph, I think you've hit on a very interesting point. And one that I think is absolutely true. There is something about the way Nintendo handles genres, which I find personally very appealing, because what they do is they take an established norm, they put a twist on it, and they make it something that is more applicable to a wider audience and more easier to get into from, like, you know, barrier of entry. So let's look at racing games, for example. I don't care about them because a lot of them are based on real cars, which I really have no affinity for. They're very sim-driven. They're very focused on, realistic physics and, you know, cornering and turning. And Nintendo has Mario Kart. And I
F-Zero.
Buy Mario Kart. And they have F-Zero, of course, as well.
And Wii Fit.
Well, let's not get ahead of ourselves.
Only one of those is alive.
Yeah. So why do I buy Mario Kart? The reason is because what Nintendo have done to that genre is they have opened it up for me in a way that I feel comfortable playing and in a way that is amenable to the things that I enjoy about games, right? It's colorful. It has a ton of personality to it. It is arcadey, like it is everything that those other games in the genre aren't. And so you look at their portfolio, and I think the reason you see a lot of people going across different genres within the Nintendo ecosystem is because despite them all being different types of games, I think Nintendo carries a certain aesthetic and design ethos with all their products, which kind of
exactly
encircles
right.
them in this kind of this group of their own, if you will.
I think that it's very easy for Nintendo fans to come across as biased based on that very description you've just said, MBZ. And I've said on the podcast before, like, we've had debates about genres and styles of games we like, but ultimately for me personally, it is that I like Nintendo games. And Nintendo holding my hand and saying, Bally, here's a genre we'd like you to try. This is our take on it, whether that's Pikmin with real-time strategy, Mario Kart with racing, or Splatoon with an online shooter. Like, it's Nintendo saying, we've got our certain brand that we apply to all these genres with a unique twist. Like you said, MBZ, Mario Kart does a lot of things. It's more arcadey than a lot of other races, more colourful, more character, etc. And they're saying, we're going to put our Nintendo stamp on it, and that's what's going to be the appeal to you. So I find a lot of console war discussions and fights can come down to where Nintendo fans versus genre fans almost, where other consoles, people might be like, oh yeah, I love adventure games. I'm obsessed by stuff like Uncharted or open world games like Assassin's Creed, and that people will buy like a group of games in that one genre and maybe reach out to a couple of other games. Whereas with Nintendo systems, many Nintendo fans, like you say in your email, Joseph, love to expand and try out a bit of Wave Race, a bit of F-Zero, a bit of Pikmin, a bit of Star Fox, like all these very different genres, but come together under one Nintendo umbrella. And for me, that's the unique selling point of Nintendo. It's, we're a video game company, we're going to let you experience a range, an array of very drastically different video games all under our umbrella, and we're going to help you play those games and make them appeal to you. And like that's ultimately why I like Nintendo. I play turn-based strategy RPGs like Fire Emblem. Like, would I do that outside of the Nintendo? Probably not.
If I came up to you, Bally, and was like, hey, play Final Fantasy Tactics,
I'd be like, MBZ, go away. I want to play a Nintendo game. And I, as a Nintendo fan, games on other systems outside of that Nintendo ecosystem can sometimes be quite intimidating, like a Final Fantasy, like Gran Turismo. Like that, these games are intimidating because they're sort of the kings of their own genres that have built up over time and created genre-based fan bases. Whereas Nintendo, like we've just discussed, is unique. It does its own thing.
It's a very interesting point you bring up there about kind of the specialization, right? I think that's very prominent in racing games. It's very prominent in fighting games as well.
Shooters?
Yeah, that too. But like, for example, Street Fighter. I don't feel comfortable buying Street Fighter because it's a very technical game. It's a game with an audience who is incredibly hardcore. And when I go and play that game online, I know I'm going to get destroyed. And then there's not really much single-player content to back that up. Whereas something with Smash Brothers, I can go online and still get destroyed, but I feel that it has a single-player stuff that I am interested in. It feels more simplified and platformy than any other fighting game is. It brings me in a way that I feel intimidated by other ones, right?
Exactly.
And I think that's a big factor is StarCraft is a real-time strategy game, and so is Pikmin technically. One
right.
of those is very friendly and open. The other one is cutthroat. And Splatoon and Call of Duty. Like, one's third person, one's first person, obviously. But
online shooters, right.
But online shooters, it's a very hard place to get into. I think the one thing that is different is, you know, there are lots of games which are kind of third-person action games, right? And I think the industry has a lot of those. Like Horizon is an open-world game. It's also kind of third-person action that's just come out. And those games, I think, are more similar to what Nintendo does. And that's why we see comparisons being drawn between Zelda and Horizon. I think Zelda's actually a very interesting case study here because it's one of those times when Nintendo have actually looked for outside inspiration for certain aspects.
Right.
But despite that, they've actually still put their twist on it. And I have heard many people, like Tim Geddes from Kind of Funny, has said he hates open world games. And he played Horizon as if it was Uncharted. He just did story mission to story mission because he hates that stuff. And yet he played Zelda and he was having fun with the open world aspects of it. And I think that's interesting because Nintendo have that way of taking genre conventions and making them appealing to people in a way
exactly.
that they usually are not.
And you just said you're not a big fan of driving games, but you enjoy Mario Kart. And like they changed the formula to appeal to a wider audience and just make some of, in my very biased opinion, the best games in the industry.
Yeah, I don't think, honestly, Bally, I think most people would say that Nintendo has the best first-party stable in the industry.
Yeah, like I think you're
it's kind
right.
of obvious,
Definitely.
Honestly.
Yeah.
The fact that they have to carry their own platform on only their games kind of makes them have to do
Gives
that.
It away.
But it's still true. And so I guess to answer the question, yeah, we're biased, but there
very.
Are reasons for that.
Definitely.
And I think Nintendo give us reasons to be that way, despite you being probably more that way than I am.
Definitely. And I need to reach out more. And when I have reached out more, I've definitely had good experiences. So it's something I should do more of.
Absolutely. It's always good to expand your horizons. So get on it. Well, I think that's all the emails we have time for today. We are going to wrap things up. And yeah, I think that's pretty much going to be the show. So, Bali, tell people where they can find you on the internet and the associated places.
Please find me on Twitter. I'm at Ballyman91. That's BallyMan91. We don't plug Miiverse anymore. It feels very strange.
You're going to keep saying that, aren't you? I know. It's going to be like the fucking, hey like, Dan Riker, welcome to New York, like, part of the show.
It's like a beat in my head that I need to replace it with something. And I don't just want to read out a Switch friend code because that's too hollow. That's too stale. I need something. What shall I say? You know what I should plug? I should plug our Twitter account for the podcast, which of course
is totally
at TNL Podcast. That's at TNL Podcast. That's the best place to go to find out when the podcast is out on iTunes, when we've got a new video up of our Let's Play that we're doing at the moment, which is of course is Wind Waker HD. We've also got our series, the Smash Brothers, The Clone Wars, where we are playing through every character fighting against each other. And yeah, check out our other series that we've done in the past, like RIP Wii U. That's one I'd highly recommend by subscribing to our YouTube channel. I'd definitely check that out.
Yeah, that's youtube.com/thisNintendoLife. Very easy to get there. Universal branding, kind of, not really.
Almost.
You can find me on Twitter. I'm at LordNBZ. You can email us, of course. We just had a nice email section there. And the email address is Bally.
ThisNintendoLife@gmail.com. That is ThisNintendoLife@gmail.com.
Absolutely. We've had a few new people writing in recently, which has been great to see. Always appreciate that. Yeah. So continue to do that. And continue to write us reviews on iTunes. iTunes is the best place to find us. You can also find us in various podcasting apps. But iTunes has the most visibility. And giving us reviews helps us go up the rankings. So we appreciate it when you go and do that. Few minutes of your time, it means the most to us out of anything you can do for the podcast. And you can find us on iTunes and in other various places. We're on Stitcher. I still need to check what the hell's going on with the Google Play thing, if that's in our country yet. It's been a while since I've mentioned it, so I'll see. I'll find out. One day we'll be on fucking Google Play. I tell you what. Maybe you'll be on Spotify one day as well. I think they're starting some podcast stuff. So,
oh boy,
it's probably a good thing to do. I think we just need to be on everything, Bally. That's the end goal here. We need to be on every podcasting platform possible.
It's a good target.
Yeah, it is, and we'll aim for it. We'll continue to aim for it. And I think that's pretty much it. I think that wraps us up, Bally. Any last closing thoughts before we leave you to finally go and finish Zelda eventually?
I'm going to go to finish Zelda. I'm going to go to Disney World. I'm going to have a grand old time.
That's going to be interesting. I want to hear you report back on the number of Switches you see at Disney World, because that's always a good barometer.
Sure.
Just for public stuff. Because I remember you telling stories about the first time you went with your 3DS and how many street passes you got and all that stuff.
Oh, boy.
So. Yeah. So, yeah, that's it's a cool thing to see. And, yeah, I hope you enjoy yourself, Bally. Have some fun in the sun while I sit here at home with the rain pouring down. Good old Scotland. We love it so. all that to say, thank you for listening. We'll see you next time. Until then, have a good one. Goodbye, everyone. The musical interlude used on today's show was Last Surprise from Persona 5, Copyright Atlas 2017.
Right, 45 minutes. Ready. Shut up.
Persona has the best fucking get-in-your-head music possible. It's just, God, it's so fucking good.